Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump expected to give a address on the shootings over the weekend at 9 a.m. Chicago time. So we'll have that. We've also heard some more pronouncements from the president about the horrific events in Dayton and El Paso over the weekend. Again, 29 dead, more than four dozen injured. By the way, in Chicago, we reported seven dead, 53 shot over the weekend. Can we include that in our national discussions of mass shootings? Don't you think we should, Charles?
Yeah, I think that not just the numbers being so high, that at least four of them had we had one that was, I think, nine shot in one shooting and seven in another. If that's not mass, I don't know what it is.
I mean, it fits the definition that a lot of these statistical outlets use for mass shootings.
I don't know. They changed the definition. They say it must be dead, right? So you can shoot 50 people. It's not a mass shooting if nobody dies.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
That's not illogical.
Yeah, right. The president had this to say over the weekend, reacting shortly after it became public what had happened in Dayton.
I want to extend our condolences to the people of El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. They're incredible people, and they've been through a lot. I just want to also thank the law enforcement in both places. The job they've done is incredible. I also want to congratulate them. I mean, nobody could have done what they've done. This could have been as bad as it was. It could have been so much worse.
Yes, on the topic of law enforcement in these situations, particularly with respect to the El Paso shooter who had this manifesto, who claimed to be influenced by white supremacist tracts like The Great Replacement, this book by a French white supremacist named Renaud Camus. On the issue of law enforcement, we talked about this with respect to Islamofascism and radical Islamists who are intent on hurting Americans at home and abroad, and what the role is for FBI and perhaps even CIA in terms of intel, because, of course, these are global operators, or the radicalization is occurring on a global scale. But in America, with respect to homegrown domestic terrorism, like white supremacy, and Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, has testified about on this topic Congress before. This was mentioned over the weekend several times. What is there we can do? What is it that law enforcement can do to try and do a better job of identifying individuals who may have violent intentions? For more on that topic, we're pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Wiki at War, as well as Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good to be with you.
One of the things that was mentioned in the coverage this weekend, and you had the founder of this website called 8chan essentially call for it to be taken down, is that there are certain places on the web, like apparently this website 8chan, that are gathering places for individuals like this shooter in El Paso. And so I wonder what you think about what the FBI in particular is doing and what more could it be doing when you're talking about to monitoring and trying to interdict domestic terrorists?
Well, you know, we ought to explain to people kind of the distinction between how we deal with transnational terrorism and how we deal with domestic terrorism, and the federal role is actually somewhat different. In transnational terrorism, these groups are linked together internationally, and in addition, they have a very specific goal, which essentially is to bring down the United States, attack U.S. targets and its allies. So it becomes a national security problem, and therefore all the instruments of national security are focused on that. And we don't make a distinction between the domestic theater and the international theater, other than the fact that in the domestic theater, we have very specific laws and policies that we have to follow, and we respect those. On domestic terrorism, whether it's eco-terrorists who are burning down forests or white supremacists who want to go in a mall and shoot somebody, the model essentially in many ways is flipped. It's public safety is a state and local responsibility. They're really on the front lines of this. The FBI is a backup to that. And the FBI also has a role if somebody has violated federal law. There are many things that a domestic terrorist might do, which might be a a violation of federal law, and the FBI would step in. You know, since the 1980s, if you think back to the Murrah office building attack, which is an act of domestic terrorism by a white supremacist, the FBI has played a prominent role in that. It has joint terrorism task force around the country. There's like 50 plus of them. They deal not just with transnational terrorism, but they also provide support dealing with domestic terrorist threats. And the FBI director recently said that the FBI recognizes it's a significant threat, and they're putting resources against that.
Okay, but the way that the FBI is putting resources against that I'm still trying to get a sense of you're describing the culture that's changed, and that's instructive. But then how has it changed in terms of what they're actually doing with respect to the approach to the homegrown terrorists that may be, you know, it sort of like there's no such thing as a lone wolf when you talk about Islamist terrorists, they're connected to something. I mean, you know, look, this book by this French white supremacist has been referenced by some of the Yellow Jackets protesting in Paris, too. I mean, it can be sort of like a manifesto that is transnational in terms of impact. But even if you don't have that nexus, what is it that the FBI maybe could additionally be doing that it's not, or how, the interaction between local and federal law enforcement?
Yeah, well, the one thing the FBI can do is they can share information, and they do that. So if this individual is connected to other individuals and there is some kind of suspicious activity, then the FBI can share that information. But if you have, I've been saying in the transnational Islamist terrorists where there are very rarely lone wolves, and that's because there actually really, really are. I mean, one of the things we have at Heritage is a database, 100-plus Islamist-related terrorist attacks aimed at the United States since 9/11 that we study, and in very few cases are these people truly isolated and on their own. Mm-hmm. Usually they connect with somebody. But oftentimes in some of these radicalized shootings that we've seen, these actually are individuals. So unless law enforcement has connected with them in some way, or someone in the community is alerted to that, then there is a chance that there might not be any warning signs. You know, I will say this, and this is one area that really, really has changed. And the deaths in El Paso and Daytona are terrible, but look at how law enforcement responded. They got to the scene, they took down the shooter in less than a minute. That's called active shooter response. That is something that has become essentially the standard in the United States over the last 10 years. In previous situations, if you 2 decades ago, if there was a shooter, the first thing you would do is you go to the scene, you would secure the scene, and then you were worried about hostage taking. Now the presumption is if somebody's shooting, they're killing people, the sooner you get there, the sooner you stop them, the safer everybody will be. And this does reflect, I think, a real shift in law enforcement, and that has saved a lot of lives.
Hi, this is Charles here. Good morning. Good to talk to you. I have a question. I don't know what the answer is, but, you know, they're talking about taking down this site. Well, they took down the site, the 8chan. But
right.
We talk about how these people are interconnected, and I'm just wondering, does it really help long term? I get the emotion of it, but
right.
if they're collecting, if they're getting together somewhere and we can track them, if we start taking all this stuff down, won't that make it harder to find them? We kind of make a mistake of assuming because somebody might have mental illness or they might be evil or whatever the case may be, that they're stupid people. So they're going to find a way to try to do this stuff. So shouldn't we kind of keep them where we know where they are? Or do we take all this stuff down and help them push them underground, but they're still acting?
Well, that's a fair point, and it's a common part of the debate. And, yeah, it's true that not just in domestic terrorism, transnational terrorism, that monitoring these networks often produces really valuable intelligence, which can be used to preempt and thwart attacks. Matter of fact, we have a long track record of that in the transnational terrorist community. You know, in the United States, when we wrote the Constitution, we asked people, do you want liberty or do you want public safety and security? And they said, yeah, we want both, right? And so the Constitution doesn't say one priority is more important than the other. It says they're both of highest priority, figure it out. And so we have, you know, very clear laws in this country already on the books. The difference between kind of publicly acceptable free speech, which can be hateful and awful, and acts which actually constitute a crime or contributory to a crime. That line's already there, and I think we have to respect that. You know, what I don't hear or what's missing from the conversation is they say, this person listened to this stuff and they radicalized online. And let's look at the number of people who maybe were exposed to similar language or sources and didn't become terrorists. Because the reality is terrorists are a tiny data set of anything other than other terrorists. And there is not a profile that says this is a bad person, because when you say, oh, well, look, he listens to this and he hates this politician. Yeah, okay, that's that terrorist profile. But you know what? I could probably give you a million people with the identical profile who've done everything the same, except they don't go out and shoot people in the morning.
Yeah, there's no question. But in terms of state and local versus federal, with respect to, I think New York City is about the only police department at the local level that has a counterterrorism unit. So isn't, if you're going to treat white supremacy as a domestic terror, there's, you know, domestic terrorist cells of white supremacists, even if they're disparate and not great in numbers, small, you know, small numbers can do great damage, as we know. Doesn't that really have to be a role the FBI fills?
Not necessarily. First of all, other major metropolitan areas have counterterrorism task force, and some states have it at the state level. So it's not just New York City, although New York City has the largest and robust CTF of any city probably in the world. They even have liaisons in foreign countries. So when terrorist attacks happen, oftentimes they get intelligence on this before the CIA and FBI do. But in addition to major metropolitan areas having some of this capacity and capability, you know, we do have what are called JTTFs, Joint Terrorism Task Force, which are led by the FBI, which includes state and local law enforcement, and don't just deal exclusively with transnational terrorism, also deal with domestic terrorism. So state and local authorities have access to this. And, you know, I will say that the number, you know, the best way to stop a terrorist is to, you know, stop them before they attack anybody. And we've done an awful lot in this country, I think, in terms of best practices to really get on top of this problem in a practical way. I think, you know, public safety in large public areas is a million times better than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. Law enforcement, coordinated law enforcement response, way better. Coordinated disaster response, way better. And even plugging into, you know, the mental health community, you know, and connecting that nexus where it's necessary between people who have legitimate health, mental health issues and access to guns and other things that might be dangerous and malicious. We've made a lot of stride. You know, much like, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the criticism I hear is people saying, oh, you're just focused on the terrorists, the foreign terrorists, and, you know, we're worried really about this white supremacist. And these were the same people that 20 years ago, they were against the Patriot Act. You know, they were against the JTTFs. Matter of fact, in cities in this country, the JTTF has been banned because it's somehow perceived as being anti-Islamic. So I find it kind of ironic that all these things they wanted, that they opposed in fighting transnational terrorism because of liberty and everything else, now because they're domestic terrorists, for some reason, they want all these tools, which they hated, which they now want to apply to domestic terrorists. And the problem is you know, when you get in the domestic environment, you know, I think we do have to worry about federalism. We do have to worry about civil liberties. It's not just about how can we stop the next shooting.
Yeah, there's no question. And I think those people that opposed those measures previously probably had less to do with liberty and a lot more to do with identity politics. But that's just my observation. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. And I thought you made a really good point. I mean, you look at some of the levels of shootings that we have going on in major cities, which are far more people die in a weekend than die in these mass shootings. And I'm not dismissing the mass shootings and saying they're terrible. But we're not having an honest conversation in this country about public safety. We're having a politicized conversation in this country. And that's why we're getting crap policy.
Okay, that's a good summation in no uncertain terms. That's why we like Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at Heritage, author of books including Wiki at War and Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
And you joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is Charles Love. He, the co-host of Black and Right, Saturdays 1 p.m. on these airwaves with his colleague John Anthony, former state representative in Illinois. And Charles, I love this piece by Tom Baudet about patriotic puttering. What what makes America great? This is over at, I saw it at AmericanConsequences.com. P.J. O'Rourke, I think, is editing that outlet. And it's just good stuff. It's very sort of Mike Rowe-ish. It's very Bernie Marcus-ish. It's about, you know, sort of the entrepreneur and just the idea that one of the things that separates Americans of all stripes from people around the world is we're putterers, in Tom Baudet's phraseology. What exactly does that mean? Well, I thought we'd have him on and ask. We're pleased to be joined by Tom Baudet, author and broadcast personality, heard regularly on NPR's satirical weekend news quiz. Wait, don't tell me. And, of course, national brand spokesman for Motel 6 for the last 30-plus years. He'll leave a light on for America's putterers. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan, thanks for having me. I appreciate you you inviting me over.
Yeah, so the what was the inspiration for the sort of this review of America's history as seen through the eyes of great American putterers throughout our nation's history?
Well, in truth, it was fed me whole cloth by my friend P.J. O'Rourke, who, as you mentioned, I've done a little bit of writing for his magazine, American Consequences, which is really fun and great. And every once in a while he tosses me a bone. And this in the July issue, he said, "Hey, we're writing about how America is already great." He knows, he lives about 40 miles from me, so we see each other from time to time, and he's got a shop, I got a shop, we're both putterers. And, he said, why don't you do something about America's putterers? And it was like right in my wheelhouse because I grew up the son of a putterer. I guess if you could call it that, you know, my dad was a do-it-yourselfer. I never once saw a plumber or an electrician or any other kind of trade professional in my house growing up. The house itself was a wreck, and he had spent my entire childhood repairing it, and with me at his side, or ahead of him in the dark crawl space. And so a putterer sort of implies leisure, right? And I don't remember that being much of a leisurely pursuit. It was more like let's keep the house out of the basement for one more year. You
know? Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what you write. And this is certainly my dad as well. We putter in our garages and basements and backyards, but it's not all just mindless work to no end. You recall some of the great putterers, as I mentioned, like Ben Franklin, who Jeff Bezos owes Amazon to, according to you.
Well, yeah, you know, I started poking around and doing a little research, which means, you know, I also have Google on my computer.
Right.
I found that Ben Franklin, he invented, in this particular order, the mail order catalog, the Franklin stove, the what am I missing? Oh, the bifocal.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the lightning rod and the flexible urinary catheter.
Sure. I mean, who doesn't remember
right?
that? Yeah. And and also a pithy aphorisms from Poor Richard's Almanac that we all use today.
Right. And, I mean, these are all great inventions, but the one, and I talk about this in the piece, the one that has always mystified me is why did it take so long to come up with the Franklin stove, essentially the wood stove. You know, what he did is he built an iron box to put in his fireplace so he could control this fire. I mean, anybody who's had a stone fireplace for more than 3 months in a Chicago winter, right, or a Vermont winter where I am, knows that they're the most efficient means there is to empty your house of heat while consuming the wood pile. And you'd think that just by accident that some Roman soldier would have leaned his shield against the fire pit one cold night and noticed that it radiated heat and kept the smoke out of his eyes and said, "Wow, I wonder if we built a box like this so we could control it." But no, it took you know, Ben Franklin to say, hey, I'm an American, to say this is BS. And and to build the iron box. So again, why 3,000 years to come up with it? I don't know, but thank you, Ben, for the wood stoves.
Hey Tom, this is Charles.
Hi Charles.
I wonder if we are. Do you think we are still encouraging people to putter? That's kind of where the things are going now. Do we still encourage innovators and people to do things that no one else is doing?
Well, you know, actually, I think, Charles, more than ever, to tell you the truth, you know, we're not necessarily teaching it in schools anymore to, my great chagrin. I really wish that, you know, shop classes and drawing classes and machine shop and all the stuff that, guys of my generation went through school doing. That's how I got my love of doing stuff and making things. I built houses for a living when I first went to Alaska in the 70s. So, you know, I went kind of professional with it, and now I run a community supported woodworking shop downtown, which I founded with some other people. And you know, we're trying to make up for where the schools aren't able to do anymore, which is to get young people interested in working with their hands and making things. But anyway, to your question, I think you look at how easy and affordable it is to go out and buy like tools and stuff now. I mean, there's a Home Depot every 5 miles somewhere, and or something just like it, Lowe's or an Ace Hardware or something. And I don't remember it ever being that way. There was a couple little hardware stores in the town I grew up in, and then a lumber yard. And I don't remember where my dad got all his stuff, but it wasn't like there was buildings full of stuff to be had as there is now. And there's nothing more fun than going to a Home Depot and watching what other people are pushing around on their carts and flats, and you can really tell the people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, that sounds like a nice little weekend, just watching what people are pushing around on their carts and flats at Home Depot.
Oh, it's hilarious. And what's really fun is listening to like the husband and wife. The husband has no idea what he's doing, right? But he's telling the wife what they're going to do. And she's like standing there with her arms folded, really doubting everything he's saying. You know, say, no, it's okay, because you just put the rubber thing between this and you put that, and it won't leak. It'll never leak, I guarantee it. And she's just like, I don't know, we probably should have called my father.
Well, so, yeah, so, I mean, the concern that would be, I think Charles raising it, is that after you, there's going to be nobody to leave a light on for anybody else because you can't screw in a light bulb. So are you encouraged by the development, sort of the renewed push for like vocational training in schools or schools that are vocationally focused so that people are learning to, make things and fix things with their hands?
Yeah, no, I am. And I think that, and I tell my own boys this, they're great kids. They're smart. And of course, they're also very lucky. They have college ahead of them if they want it. And, but I never discount the fact that, hey, you guys, you know what? Electrician's a pretty darn good job, and it's a good life. And, I look at the trade professionals I know around here, the plumbers and the electricians and various contractors, and they do great. They raise their families. They go on vacation. They got a bass boat out back. To some degree, they can set their own hours, and they're making great wages these days. There's how it is to find somebody to come fix your plumbing these days. I mean, they're in high demand, so they're very good jobs, and I think that more kids should be steered toward them at a young age, because you can get into these trades without ending up with $200,000 in student debt too.
Yeah, and I like the sort of argument you make in your piece that I'm referencing, where you talk about it's not so much America's can-do spirit. That's sort of a misnomer. It's America's must-do spirit. What's the distinction?
Yeah, well, I think one of the examples I use in the piece is the space program. And, we went to the moon just because. It was really just to stick our thumb in the eye of the Soviets. But there was no real reason for it. What did we get out of it? We got a couple hundred pounds of rocks, And the thing is that we knew going in that we were going to get rocks out of it, and that was about it. You know, the fact that we got Velcro and transistors was kind of lucky. But we did it just because, you know, we couldn't just have that moon up there circling around with nobody on it. So we took care of that.
But you got to, but that's the point, right? So you do something like that, or a group of people do something like that, and then somebody improves upon it with the satellites and the space stations. It's very much like the homemade watermelon cannon that you write about as well. So Gallagher is smashing watermelons on stage with the Sledge-O-Matic, and then somebody invents inspired to invent a watermelon cannon, right? So you see these developments.
That's right. I mean, and I think the watermelon cannon is an unsung icon of American.
No question. It's at least as important as Apollo 11.
Well, and I just want, just for the listeners that have no context, I was watching that news crawl at the bottom of CNN or one of these news shows a few years ago, and this thing went by. It just said, "Man fires watermelon through Pontiac with homemade cannon." and that was the last I heard of the story. I tried to look it up, nothing. I don't know if it was Pontiac, a car that he shot a watermelon through,
Michigan,
or the city of Pontiac, Michigan. I was just intrigued by this. I mean, I wasn't that interested in the watermelon cannon. Of course somebody makes a watermelon cannon. but what did he do with it? That's what I wanted to know. I still don't know.
Do you, thinking about this like more globally, though, and some sort of from a policy and culture perspective, I mean, I know you said people are puttering more than ever. You've got the Home Depots and the Lowe's and all the home improvement projects. But do you worry about a declining sense of entrepreneurship generally, more beyond puttering in the house, but really being having a must-do spirit in terms of creating and innovating?
Well, you know, I gotta say, you know, that I read more about that than I see it. You know, mm-hmm. there's this, you know, they call it like the makerspace movement. I don't know if you've come across it. They're all over the place. These things called makerspaces where they're big, and it's kind of what we're doing with our woodworking shop at Hat Space. Only makerspaces are generally all kinds of disciplines. You'll have upholsterers in there, electronics, woodworkers, ironworkers, jewelry makers, any number of crafts. And they're generally people who are trying to get something going, you know, like maybe they've been making jewelry in their basement a little bit, but they want to make it a little bigger. Or maybe they don't have the resources for some of the machines that you need to really scale it up and become a business. And that's what these makerspaces have been doing, kind of incubating people to get out and make things. And it's crazy. Like, if you start looking this up, like, look up makerspaces in the Chicago area, I would be so surprised if there wasn't 100 of them. There.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. It's sort of like the tech incubators, but that's sort of the same concept, just different disciplines.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, that you can't stop us doing this stuff. I mean, you can stop teaching it in schools. I mean, some of the tools that we have on our shop floor were donated to us by the local middle school who took their shop out like 3 years ago. Mm. So on the one hand, that's really sad that we have the tools of the school and they don't have them anymore. On the other hand, we have them and we're making them available to young people to find through a different route. So this is why I think, you know, this is the part of our country that I love the best, is that you can make policy day and night and we're still going to do the things that we're going to do.
Yeah, good stuff.
And we're finding ways to do it.
He is Tom Beaudet. He is, of course, the longtime 30-plus years national brand spokesman for Motel 6. He's also an author and the broadcast personality you can hear regularly on NPR's Great Show, which is Wait, Don't Tell Me. And check out his piece, which I'll tweet out at Dan Proft, about patriotic puttering, which he was just describing. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Yay, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Take care. And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.